day, and welcome to the fourth presentation of Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Alicia. This is Fred Riche, and I am the head of the Drinker Biddle ERISA practice for service provider or financial institution clients. We primarily represent service providers and their services to plans, but also plans and obtaining the services of service providers. With me is Brad Campbell. Brad is also with Drinker Biddle. I'm in the LA office. Brad is in the Washington, D.C. office. So good morning from me and good afternoon from Brad. Brad, more importantly, is a former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Labor's Employee Benefits Security Administration. In other words, he headed up the regulatory and enforcement part of the Department of Labor for retirement plans and for health and welfare plans. The session today is being recorded. We'll have Q&As at the end. Within a few days, the session will be posted on our website if you want to listen to it again or if you want to refer a friend to it. That's www.drinkerbiddle, the first two names of the firm is one word, drinkerbiddle.com/beltway, B-E-L-T-W-A-Y. Okay, with that introduction, let's jump right into this. As you all know, if you've listened to this before, Brad and I go back and forth on a number of issues. We're going to start with what's going on the legislative front. We'll move into the administrative agencies, and then we'll end up talking about a couple of court cases that I think are relevant to you all. To start this off, though, Brad, let's talk a little bit about the president's budget, tax proposals, what Congress may or may not do. And let's start that by talking about the president's budget and how it addresses the staff levels at the Department of Labor. Off to you, Brad.
Well, thanks a lot, Fred, but most importantly, thanks to all of you for taking a little bit of time to be with us here today. As Fred said, this is our fourth one, and we've been very pleased with your support, so thank you very much. So the president released his FY 2014 budget, which has all the requests and proposals, talks about not just staffing levels and money, but also some of the initiatives and things that the administration wants to pursue. If you look at the budget for the Department of Labor Employee Benefits Security Administration, you see that the budget has actually declined slightly, but all of that cut in the budget request really is coming out of research grants that the department might be doing on employee benefits issues. So in terms of its enforcement capacity, that is being funded more or less flat, but that flat funding is already an enhancement over the last 2 years from what it had been previously. So cumulatively, the department's up, EBSA is up to 1,003 in its budget request, full-time equivalent. So it's not a direct translation of people to say 1,003 staff, but you know, think of it that way. It's easy to think of it. And that's a good 150 or so people more than they had at the start of the Obama administration. So this is a continuing the increase in predominantly enforcement staff. Now, obviously, some of that's also going to healthcare. But a lot of that's being directed towards retirement plans and the enforcement there that complements what's been going on with the various regulations like the fiduciary proposal and so forth. So I think what's also worth highlighting is one of the main enforcement projects that they're working on, which is the Fiduciary Service Provider Compensation Project. They started that in last year and will be continuing it. And what they're looking at is the receipt of improper or undisclosed compensation by employee benefit plan consultants and other investment advisors. And it will include also potential criminal investigations. If you look at their enforcement results from last year, they had a pretty good year. They did 3,566 civil investigations, pulled in $1.3 billion in monetary results, almost, just shy of $1.3. And they had 318 criminal investigations and 117 indictments. So as you can see, the enforcement's a very active and ongoing part, and their budget request for FY14 is going to continue these trends, which we've been seeing. The biggest one, again, I think to emphasize, and we've certainly seen it in our practice, is a real focus on service providers and looking at their compensation arrangements and their fiduciary status.
Brad, if I remember some of our conversations accurately, over the past several years, I think you said that the level of investigations of plan sponsors has remained about the same, notwithstanding the increase in investigators, but that the increase has exhibited itself in the DOL investigations of service providers. Did I get that right?
More or less. Now, this is one of those things that's hard to prove by just looking at the publicly available numbers. I mean, they're hard to crunch that way. Certainly, we know that they have more investigators now than they ever have before. They haven't had the, you know, doubling of the investigative staff that, you know, you might see rumors circulating about, but they have had a, you know, fairly substantial increase in investigators. And we've also seen this sort of shift in enforcement focus. Whether that means they're doing significantly fewer plan-sponsored-directed investigations is kind of hard to tell from the data, but what is clear is that they are doing more service provider investigations. And from 2011 to 2012, they did do more investigations. They did about an additional 100 or so investigations. So, and that itself is up from a bit from years past. So there's clearly a trend in that direction.
You know, and representing some broker-dealers and RIAs and record keepers, which we'll get to a little later on, in DOL investigations, it seems to me, at least for the broker-dealers and the RIAs, they're focusing on acknowledged fiduciary status. That is, they're focusing on situations where the fiduciaries have acknowledged that they're acting, or where the advisors have acknowledged that they're acting as a fiduciary, and not as much on situations where they would have to prove that the advisor had become a functional fiduciary. And the things they're looking for, at least in the cases I've been involved in, have been where the advisor is charging a fee, but they're also receiving other compensation, regardless of whether it's disclosed or not, but that other compensation would result from the fiduciary status. For example, charging a fee for giving investment advice and then receiving 12b1 fees or other compensation on top of that as a result of the advice given. So we are seeing them in these service provider fiduciary investigations dig down into the income being earned and then asserting prohibited transaction violations. Well, Brad, I guess, you know, a little bit about what does that mean to people listening. I mean, to me, I think it means that their odds of being investigated have been increased, and I think it means that the focus will be on forms of compensation that are either hidden, that is not known to the fiduciary, or that are the result from the advice given, that is, that the advice causes the advisor to get additional compensation. Is that your read on this too?
I think that's generally correct. I mean, I think the department is looking at this as kind of a 1-2, I guess you'd say, punch on enforcement. One step is everyone declaring themselves to be a fiduciary who should be? And I think DOL is really using the fiduciary regulation proposal, changing the rule by which you would be considered a fiduciary, as the way to address that. And in part, if you look at the history of that proposed regulation, one of the things DOL complains about in the preamble and uses as a rationale for promulgating that rule is that, you know, if you have to take someone who says they're not a fiduciary and prove that they are by walking through the five-step regulatory test, that can be very difficult and time-intensive for the agency. So they're looking to make that easier from an enforcement standpoint by essentially making many more, if not all, advisors, depending on what the regulation ends up doing, fiduciaries. The second is then looking at folks in an immediate enforcement environment, looking at folks who are saying and agree that they are fiduciaries, and as you said, looking at whether their arrangements to use a non-legal term, looking at whether their arrangements are kosher. You know, are they getting variable compensation nonetheless? Are they getting payments from some other source that they shouldn't be getting? Has all that been disclosed, as you said? So there's definitely a focus, particularly on fiduciary advisors, in terms of current enforcement.
An area that has just started being brought to my attention by clients on that is where an advisor may get a bonus payment from a record keeper or bundled provider because of the volume of business they place with them. So it you know, without reaching a final determination on whether or not that's a prohibited transaction, it's certainly, I think, under the DOL definitions, additional compensation. But, you know, that's the kind of thing I think people have to start paying attention to is, are you getting any other money or things of monetary value, for example, computers, software, anything else attributable to the services you're providing to plans, you know, particularly to the fiduciary services that you're providing to plans. So I think going forward, everybody ought to just be much more careful about every form of compensation or benefit that they receive.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. This is sort of fallout from the 408B2 disclosure. As you said, separate from questions as to whether any of those payments are improper or result in prohibited transactions, there's a disclosure element now that didn't exist a year ago. And that disclosure element alone can be an entangling factor for service providers. And you know, depending on what you're reporting and which for which purpose, 408B2 or the Schedule C or all the other things that might apply, there are different ways to look at what's reportable and what isn't. It's becoming a much more complex area, and I agree. We're seeing a lot more of these issues coming up in our practice and helping our clients sort through, you know, what to report to whom, when, and how.
That's great, Brad. I like that phrase, entangling factor. I may have to steal that from you. But it is. It's a problem, and people need to be paying attention to it. Well, let's move from the Department of Labor to the IRS. I understand that the IRS is beginning to look more closely at IRAs, individual retirement accounts, and to do some enforcement in that area. Brad, can you bring us up to speed on that?
Yeah, the IRS just recently, just a little over a month ago, formally told Congress that it is going to be focusing, actually between now and September 30th of this year, so it's a very near-term focus, on issues related to the tax reporting and other concerns about individual retirement accounts. In particular, it seems that they're focusing on three big things: whether people are taking the distributions they're required to take, whether people are having excessive contributions to those accounts, and issues associated with inherited IRAs. A part of this appears to be driven by sort of, you know, the Inspector General and others historically saying this is an area the IRS has let slip a lot of violations. But also, frankly, part of it seems to be driven by, the current fiscal circumstances, and that, you know, as one advisor put it in a Wall Street Journal article that came out a while back, you know, that this is low-hanging fruit. If the agency can take the data it already has and do a better job of cross-referencing it and using it, then it can find a lot of revenue fairly quickly. And the consequences can be significant. There's an additional 6% tax that would apply, for example, to the excess contributions and earnings. So there's, and that's where I'm going to stop talking about the actual tax law, because as, you know, Inspector Callahan in the Dirty Harry movie said, a man's got to know his limitations. And while I speak tax, it's not my native tongue. So I'll kind of leave it there and just say, for a lot of the advisors out there, if you haven't heard about this, this is a real near-term thing that it behooves you to look at your clients and make sure that they're doing their IRA business correctly.
Yeah, this sort of segues into the fiduciary regulation also, and it's not a difficult segue, even though without me explaining it, it may sound improbable. From my perspective, the IRS has failed to properly audit individual retirement accounts over the years. And as a result, whatever tension that would have added to the system, whatever level of compliance that would have encouraged, it just didn't happen. And consequently, bad practices were allowed to build up. If with my definition of bad practices being practices that violated the law, whether the law makes sense or not is another issue. But over the years, there's been very little audit activity for IRAs, and I think that's changing. One example of the effect of the lack of enforcement has been when the DOL issued its proposed regulation expanding the definition of fiduciary advice. People were saying, where did the Department of Labor ever get authority to write rules about IRAs? Well, it was under a presidential delegation order many, many years ago. It's always been that way. I mean, always in my professional lifetime been that way. But people just didn't know that because the IRS has been missing in action. And the DOL has had the authority for many, many years to write the regulations for the fiduciary and prohibited transaction rules under Section 4975 of the Internal Revenue Code. And in fact, they wrote them. If you look at the fiduciary definition for IRAs, it is verbatim the same as the fiduciary definition under ERISA. But because of that lack of enforcement, people didn't realize that those rules applied. But if you think about it for a minute, that means if an advisor gives individualized advice based on the particular needs of the IRA owner, that was a fiduciary act. And if the advisor gave advice that caused himself to be paid money in addition to the advisory fee or variable compensation from third parties, that always has been a fiduciary or a prohibited transaction under the Internal Revenue Code, as well as it would be under ERISA in a plan situation. So there's just a whole lack of knowledge and a lack of enforcement, a lack of tension, compliance in the IRA area. Fortunately, I don't think that's meant that there are a lot of abuses, but I think that's part of the reason that that practices have built up in a certain way over many years within IRAs, and now there's a lot of objection to the change in the definition of fiduciary. But if you really look at the existing definition, the objections are actually to what it says right now, and perhaps to that being enforced.
I think I would clarify that just a little bit and disagree just slightly in that while I think it's clear that the Department of Labor has always asserted that they had jurisdiction over interpreting the prohibited transaction rules under 4975, and thus that if you were a fiduciary and you were giving advice as an IRA provider to an IRA account holder, that you would have to be doing so in accordance with, you know, the prohibited transaction rules that would govern how you could be paid. What I think is different, though, about the DOL proposal, which, you know, presumably we'll see here reproposed sometime this year, is that by changing the five-part test as to when you're a fiduciary, when you're giving that advice to the IRA account holder, it has made a difference. I sort of like to think of it as if the speed limit was 90 and then they reduced it to 40, you may not have noticed that the law existed because you never drove 90 to begin with. You know, if the effect of the DOL proposed regulation on fiduciary is to really interact, really affect all those interactions with folks who had not structured their relationship to be fiduciary in the IRA context, it really is disruptive. So, you know, I think we're saying the same thing, but I think the question that all this turns on is, was the conduct that the IRA provider in giving some form of advice to the IRA holder, was that conduct such that it reached the five-part test that DOL is looking to change? And if it wasn't, then this wasn't a concern. If it was, then it was. Getting lost in a forest to be conjugating the verb to be. So hopefully you all followed my tangled reasoning there.
Yeah, as best I can tell, you're saying it depends on what the definition of is.
Well, let's not go that far. If you're going to call me out on that, I'm going to just let the IRS know that it was Fred who said harsh things about your enforcement capacity. I also hear he's very interested in promoting the Constitution.
Yeah. Don't call your IRA patriot IRA. I was really talking more about the typical situation, Brad, where, you know, the three big changes are it takes out the word regular in the sense that the advice has to regularly be given. But I think most people working with advisors working with plans and IRAs give advice on a regular basis. I hope they do anyway. The second is that it requires, takes out the requirement that the understanding that the advice is to be relied on is mutual. But I think in most cases where advisors work with plans and IRA holders, there's some mutuality of understanding that the advisor will give advice and that the plan sponsor will consider it. And then it takes out the third requirement, the proposal, the DOL proposal takes out the third requirement, which is that the advice be intended to be a primary consideration, not the primary, but a primary consideration. It just says that it's a consideration. And I think in most cases when the advisor is making a recommendation and the IRA owner or the plan sponsor is listening to it, that they both understand that that's meant to be an important part of the deliberations of the fiduciary or the IRA owner. So you're right. At the margins, it does make a difference. But if you look at the typical case, it really turns on language that I don't think is being changed between the existing fiduciary regulation and the proposal, which is that it be individualized advice based on the particular needs of the plan or the IRA holder. In any event, there is room to disagree on that, and we're talking about something we don't even know what it's going to say anyway, so let's use this as perhaps as an opportunity to just conclude by saying, what do we think this means to people? What's the reality of this? And from my perspective, I think there is at least an outside chance there could be more enforcement in the IRA area, and that but the most common practices are going to continue to be okay. Regardless of the definition of fiduciary for IRA purposes, there is a privative transaction exemption that essentially solves much of the problem, which is privative transaction class exemption 86-128, which takes away much of the pain of compliance with some of these rules, because it makes it compliant to receive, for example, variable fees for services to IRAs. But I think there we all, I mean, so I would be a little more careful with IRAs, but I think I would, it's really hard to make decisions about IRAs in this environment, because we're going to get a proposed regulation in a matter of months, but we're also going to get proposed privative transaction exemptions that if they build on 86-128, I think most of the normal practices will be acceptable. But do you agree, Brad?
Well, you know, again, I think there's room to disagree over exactly how much the current regulation bites in terms of how much of the interaction between IRA providers and IRA account holders is actually fiduciary in nature, which is one of the contentious issues that was in the original proposal that was withdrawn. The other thing I'll throw out there is, you know, we're anticipating that in the new proposal on fiduciary rule, whenever it's proposed, presumably later this year, there'll be some sort of additional language addressing rollover options, which will further complicate potentially, or perhaps simplify. We'll have to wait and see what they do. But if I were a cynical betting man, which I've been known to be, I'll say we'll probably further complicate the rollover process, which could raise, you know, as you said, IRAs are becoming a somewhat difficult area to plan right now between the IRS and DOL and the changing policies. And I think we might see even more changes in this fiduciary rule that could impact that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take that as an opportunity to move on to the proposal by the administration. It's commonly said that it would cap retirement benefits at $3 million. That may require a little explanation, but why don't you walk us through that, Brad?
Yeah, well, rather than get too hung up on too many of the details, because you know, if any of you ever tried to read the federal budget, and I hope you haven't, because it's an exercise in frustration, each provision is listed several different places, so you have to go to about three different sources in the giant mass of documents that compose the budget to figure out exactly what was proposed. And in essence, I think the easiest way to think about it is the administration said that if you're using, across all your kind of individual and DC accounts, if you're amassing an amount of wealth which will generate more than $205,000 in annuity income, which is linked to sort of the defined benefit qualified, sort of the maximum annuity stream on a qualified DB plan, then you have accumulated essentially an unreasonable level of retirement savings. How they would actually implement that, it's really a tangled thicket of complexity. I don't know why, but for some reason I keep like to try out these untested phrases today. But the bottom line, the president was basically saying you shouldn't be able to accumulate too much in these tax-preferred accounts, at least not more than you could get in a DB plan, is the easiest way to think about it. This proposal isn't going anywhere, in all likelihood. Both sides of the aisle seem to dislike the notion of sort of capping that level of savings. And there are a lot of questions about how it would mechanically work. You know, if interest rates go up, the amount of money necessary to generate that kind of annuity income would go down, potentially quite significantly. So it could really have some impact, especially on younger workers who have longer investment horizons and are using these accounts more and more than some of their older counterparts. I think the broader issue it highlights is that, you know, tax reform remains probably less an imminent concern than it might have been before, but still remains a concern in the retirement space. because Congress has the ability here to change the tax treatment of qualified plans in a way that could be potentially quite harmful. But we don't yet know whether they will go down the road of tax reform. We don't know exactly what they might do if they decided to do it. But the president's budget proposal is a good example of how ideas no one had really heard about before could pop up, proposed by very senior people, very quickly in the middle of a debate like that.
Yeah, I agree it would be it's extraordinarily complex. It would be very difficult to administer, and hopefully it will be dead on arrival, because I can't imagine the amount of work that would go into trying to make that thing work, independent of whether it is conceptually a good idea or not. Brad, what do you think about? I mean, what do you think has some possibility then of all of the various proposals that are floating around D.C., if some revenue is going to be raised from retirement plans and you had to lay some odds, where do you think that is?
Well, the safest bet is what they've already chosen to do, so that makes it a little harder to go back to the well on. But all of the changes that they've been putting out there, facilitating greater use of Roth accounts, was sort of a freebie from the perspective of tax policy, in that it generated revenue now but didn't really fundamentally change the treatment of other tax-preferred savings vehicles. So from Congress's perspective, it was an easy thing to make Roth more available and raise some revenue without really generating much controversy. Now you can debate whether that revenue is real or would ever actually be realized, but that's sort of a, as you said earlier, whether the law makes sense is a different question. So from that perspective, Roth, if they could continue to tweak that, if there's anything left, that's something I think they would look to first. I think the one of the risks of tax reform is looking at whether they would do things like reduce the amount you can contribute on a pre-tax basis. So whether that's reducing $17,500 down, whether it's just eliminating the inflation indexing going forward, all of those are things that would be determined by the amount of revenue that Congress has decided to raise and then the available ways to do it. The reason you hear a lot about tax reform from all the various groups out there, ASPA and others, is because the potential for them to make a change that could be harmful in terms of disincenting particularly small businesses to offer plans is present. I mean, they could do things that would really have a negative effect. Alternatively, they could make changes at the margins that would raise a little revenue without fundamentally unsettling things. And I think if tax reform happens, that's probably the direction a lot of us in defending the retirement system will be pushing them towards.
Yeah, it seems to me that by reducing the total amount that can go in each year, employer or employee combined, in some way, or limiting future cost of living increases, if Congress had to do it, they could nibble at the edges. And those nibbles, if you want to call them that, would be would primarily affect the highly compensated, because they're the ones that are putting in the larger amounts. If that's the case, if that does happen, but let's assume that Congress does this in an intelligent way so that they don't really hurt the future formation of plans, particularly by smaller employers. It seems to me that there are some ways that advisors and providers can still help plan sponsor clients. For example, if the limits of the highly compensated in small companies or large companies are reduced, I think you should look for ways to increase the retirement savings for those people. For a large company, one obvious way is through non-qualified deferred compensation. I think there are other ways, like stock options or stock bonuses, that can also increase retirement benefits for the highly compensated. When you get down to smaller companies, I think that depending on the degree of cutback on the defined contribution limits, if any, that we could see a growth now that we're coming out of the recession and the economy is improving, we could see a growth in defined benefit plans and cash balance plans. Because it seems like, other than the president's proposal, that so-called $3 million limit, that the efforts are going to be to limit what you can do in defined contribution plans, but not limit what you can do in defined benefit plans, which would include cash balance plans. Therefore, there's an opportunity through well-designed defined benefit and cash balance plans to make up for any difference. And I think what, you know, what they forget in Washington, D.C. a lot is that we can adjust in the private sector to what they do in D.C. And as a result of these adjustments, it may not have the revenue-raising effect that they want to begin with. In any event, I do think we're going to have to wait and see what the changes are. And I guess that'll be thought out over the rest of the year.
It would appear that way. Some folks are saying tax reform is less likely in part because of the difficulties the IRS is facing in various investigations of its conduct and how that can take up the time of the very committees that would otherwise be working on reform. Others are saying that we're seeing, because of the sequestration and therefore reduced spending as well as the economy improving, we're seeing budget annual deficits shrink. Not, of course, eliminate, but shrink in a relative sense, say from $800 billion a year to $500 billion a year, because that's taking some of the pressure off of reform. That said, this is one of those issues you want to keep your eye on because these are the sorts of things that are never dead until they're actually dead, and we're certainly not at that point.
Okay, well, let's move on. What about the nomination of the candidate for the Secretary of Labor and how that may affect the fiduciary rules timing?
Yeah, now Mr. Perez was recently voted out of the Senate Health Committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which is the primary committee of jurisdiction over the Secretary of Labor nominees. He was reported out on a pure party line vote. All the Republicans opposed his nomination. All the Democrats supported it. Part of the reason for that has been controversy over decisions he's made as the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division. Part of it is over procedural issues. The committees have requested a bunch of information which they don't, the Republicans don't feel they've received, and the House side has got pending subpoenas on personal email accounts and how often those have been used and whether they were used as a dodge for, official business, et cetera. So there's a lot of that kind of dispute going on. In the Senate, the Republicans and Democrats are negotiating over when and how his nomination might come to the floor. The timing on that's unclear. A number of Republicans are looking to filibuster it, but not necessarily clear yet whether that'll happen and what the Democratic response would be. So, kind of the usual debate is going on about his nomination and whether and when and how it goes forward. I think for us the significance is DOL is unlikely to put forward any controversial regulations in the middle of that Senate confirmation process. It would be pouring, gasoline on the fire. So I would be surprised if we even see the fiduciary regulation be referred to OMB. In the regulatory process, when an agency is ready to send a regulation out, they send it to the White House for review, typically about a 90-day review that goes to the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the White House. We know when that has happened because OMB reports that it has occurred on the website, but we still won't know what's actually in the proposed regulation until it's published, months later. They haven't yet sent it to the White House, and I would be surprised if they even do that while this nomination is pending just because of the additional controversy it would generate. So, my assumption is we're not going to see a whole lot of short-term action on the fiduciary rule, at least until this nomination is resolved.
Okay, thanks. Let's move on to a recent issuance by the Department of Labor. The DOL has issued some guidance that, if ultimately implemented, would require that participants on their quarterly statements be given projections of retirement income. That is, what will your account balance, your contributions, your earnings, the employer contributions equal in terms of monthly income and retirement? Brad, this was issued as a ANPRM. What the heck is an ANPRM?
Well, that's technically an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, and what this gets to is the Administrative Procedure Act, which governs the regulatory process. There's several different ways you can make a rule, and the traditional way DOL does it is by issuing an NPRM, which is the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. In other words, DOL typically issues a proposal. We all get 60 to 90 days to comment on it. then they chew on the comments, and then come out with a final rule, you know, a year or so later. What they're doing in this process, which I applaud, by the way, I think this is a smart way to do this rule, they are doing it in a three-step instead of a two-step process. So this ANPRM is sort of a pre-rule. It's, if we were going to issue a proposal, it would maybe kind of sort of look like this, give us your thoughts on all these elements. And that's what they just released. So we've seen sort of the outline of what looks a lot like a proposal, but technically isn't. We get the opportunity to comment on this pre-proposal. Then presumably they'll issue a proposal, which we'll get to comment on, and then a final rule down the road. Given the complexity and just the technical issues here, the importance of how these projections would be calculated, again, I think this is a good move by the department to get more public input on what are going to be some very, you know, tricky issues.
Okay. And then about how long do you think this whole process will take, the preliminary, the proposal, the final? If you had to put a time frame on that, what are we looking at, a year, year and a half before we get to a final?
Well, I'd say minimum of a year and a half in all likelihood. I mean, if they go through regular order, you've got, you know, they put it out, so now you've got the several months of comments, then they have to chew on the comments, then they have to rewrite the rule and rewrite the economic justification, and then they send it to the White House, and the White House takes up to 90 days to look at it, and then it gets published. Then we get another 60 to 90 days of comments, and then they have to chew on those, and then they have to rewrite the rule and rewrite the economic analysis and send it to the White House, and then that takes 90 days. So, yeah, you add all those time frames up. It's not a short process. But I also don't think people should view that as a reason not to be concerned yet. While this will be a long regulatory process, this first step is actually extremely important because it's our first glimpse at what DOL is really thinking. And so things like the numbers they've chosen for, you know, return on assets and inflation adjusters and, you know, what should, you know, should it be an annuity or a withdrawal strategy or, you know, how is this stream of payments calculated? All of those are important questions that this first opportunity to comment on is actually extremely important. So we're helping many of our clients make comments on that, and certainly would urge anyone listening who has an interest in this, which I frankly think is everyone. I mean, you know, how a participant views the value of their plan can be heavily influenced by this retirement income projection. You know, if I'm a young worker and I'm defaulted in, and it looks to me like this is not a good deal because I'm going to get such a little teeny amount of income 40 years from now, that's a real disincentive to stay in the plan. So doing this right actually has some pretty significant repercussions for everybody.
Yeah, let me walk you through a little bit about where the DOL is right now. And you know, when they said, here's what we're thinking about. There's projections during the accumulation period and then projections for the distribution period. The DOL is thinking about requiring two sets of projections, if you will, for the accumulation period. The first one is you just take your current account balance and then treat it as if you were 62 today and started taking distributions. So, and it doesn't assume any future earnings in the accumulation period. It doesn't assume any future contributions or deferrals during accumulation periods. It treats you as if you were at retirement today with your current account balance. Of course, it does have to have assumptions about the distribution period built into there. So that's the first projection, if you will. The second one they're thinking about, and they're thinking about having both, is that you project between where you are today and your assume your retirement under the plan, which would be, say, 65. Actually, both of these would be your retirement age under the plan, at least in their initial thinking, as opposed to, say, Social Security retirement age, which would make more sense to me.
Well, that's something they actually asked for some comment on. They could go with 62, 65, 71, you know, the plan's retirement age. There's a lot of options, and that's one of the things they wanted to explore.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, there's a lot of data now that people are retiring older and older, even though it's still in the early 60s. But it's, in any event, the projecting to the retirement age, whatever it is, with a series of assumptions. And I'll talk about the assumptions in a minute. But just the fact that you project to retirement age and then you convert to lifetime income. There are some studies out now that show that if you provide participants with information like this, that people do save more and make more intelligent decisions about, or at least more informed decisions about retirement. Also, the DOL has posted a calculator on their website, a retirement income calculator that will help individuals do this on their own. The way this works in terms of the assumptions is there are two general rules. There's a general rule that essentially says you have to have reasonable assumptions during the accumulation period. Then there's a safe harbor for the accumulation period that says if you use these exact assumptions for projecting to retirement, then the plan sponsor has a safe harbor. Because remember, this burden will be placed on the plan sponsor, even though it'll probably be satisfied by providers. Then there's another general rule in retirement, which essentially says if you have reasonable assumptions, that's what's required. But then there's a safe harbor there also that says if you use these specific assumptions during the retirement period, you, the plan sponsor, will get a safe harbor. And there will be comments filed on this. My general impression right now is that most plan sponsors and therefore most providers are going to want to use the safe harbor. So it's important in comments to focus on those safe harbor assumptions. Now, why would you take any risk if the safe harbor is clear and reasonable? If you think about this, though, in terms of what it really means in the future, assuming that something comes out that requires projections of retirement income of any kind, that's the first step. A participant will see you're going to get $700 a month in retirement based on your current behavior. The next question that a participant should ask is, well, what do I need? I mean, that's fine for what I'm going to get, but what do I need if I take this into account on Social Security? Will I have enough? And so I think the private sector won't be mandated by the government. I think the private sector will step up to the plate and will say, you know, it's commonly accepted, and then there'll be a benchmark. For example, the most common benchmark I'm seeing is that a retiree should have an income replacement ratio of 80% of final pay, taking into account Social Security and retirement plans and other assets. So I think somewhere around 80% will probably become the benchmark. You know, the problem with the benchmark is it's exactly right for nobody. But the importance of a benchmark is that it gives you at least a starting point for people who aren't going to take the time to customize, to individualize through the use of calculators and that sort of thing, what their personal needs are. But what if you're only on target to get 60% and the benchmark is 80%? What's the next question that a participant should ask? Well, it's the obvious. What do I need to do to get to 80%? You know, short of asking, do I really need 80? The obvious question is, what do I need to get to 80? How do I close that gap? That's called gap analysis. And I think the private sector will step up to the table and will provide gap analysis information to participants. And I think all of this will be provided in a way where the participant doesn't have to go to a website, but they'll be given that information. It will be delivered into the hands of the participant at some point in the not too distant future. I think that some providers will, and in fact already are, going to take this on as an initiative for helping their plan sponsor clients and participants. It's for everybody's benefit in the sense that participants will have more adequate retirement income. Providers will have more assets. It's one of those win-win situations which should get fairly universal support from the retirement plan community.
Except it comes to the details of how you actually do it. And this is the thing that I think raises a lot of concerns in the DOL pre-rule proposal here. Is first of all, by having a safe harbor, as Fred very accurately said, I think that's going to drive people to the safe harbor. And if the safe harbor has specific number assumptions, which in this pre-rule, for example, they assume 7% rate of market return, a 3% inflation discount, a 3% increase in participant contributions to the retirement date, if those numbers are fixed by regulation, which they would be here, it's very difficult to ever change that. So how the safe harbor is structured would be extremely important, as Fred said, and how accurate this benchmark that's sort of a one-size-fits-all approach is. And I think what we're going to see a lot in the comments are people talking about the safe harbor and saying on the one hand, one strain of comments will be, yes, we want certainty, we want a safe harbor that lays out exactly what we do, so we're not taking any risk. The other set of comments will be, you can't possibly put in just one number for all these assumptions and expect it to be right for everybody. Plus, you're stifling innovation for those of us who are trying to help participants to do those gap analysis. So we're going to see a lot of robust comments and discussion about whether the approach DOL is taking in this pre-rule is good or bad overall, as well as how it'll impact a lot of different situations.
I agree absolutely with Brad on that. The comments need to be, you know, robust, and the DOL has to consider them in a way that there's some flexibility for the future, yet at the same time a safe harbor. The one thing I will point out, though, is that every year, if a participant starts getting these projections at age 35, every year they get more accurate, almost no matter what assumptions are used. That is, at age, let's say he's going to retire at 65. At age 35, the participant has 30 years of assumptions he has to live through to get to the retirement age. At age 45, 20 years of assumptions. At age 55, 10 years of assumptions. So by definition, they'll be getting this quarterly so they can adjust along the way, and they'll be getting it in a way where every year that goes by, there's one less year of impact of assumptions and one more year of impact of what's really happened. So there is a certain self-proving that goes on, and you can't just assume that participants are going to be given these projections once and they're never going to get them again, and by God, it better be right. By definition, it won't be right. No matter what we come up with, it will be assumptions. But they will become, but by giving it to the participants regularly, they will chart a good course. Obviously, we want good assumptions. Don't get me wrong. But I do think we have to keep in mind that this becomes self-effectuating along the way. Brad, we're running a little short on time.
Let me just interrupt one thing to say. I think that's generally true. The only problem is, again, if these assumptions are one size fits all, you know, if you're 55, on the one hand, there's fewer years of assumption. On the other hand, if the assumption is a 7% rate of return and 2008 happens in the middle of that and your personal investments are such that they're, you know, heavily weighted and riskier investments, your experience could be quite radically different than the projection. So it goes back to the importance of what you fill that safe harbor with and how you calculate that as to what level of sort of accuracy it might ultimately have.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think that the maybe what can be said is that you get the safe harbor if you use fixed assumptions, but that maybe you could also provide a range of outcomes based on Monte Carlo simulations without losing the safe harbor. I think you'd have to go to something like Monte Carlo simulations to deal with what you're talking about, Brad, because I don't think any single set of assumptions, any safe harbor assumptions, can get you there. So maybe what we really need is for the DOL to build in some flexibility to allow alternative or rather additional assumptions that show a range without causing the loss of the safe harbor.
And then the last thing to point out on the safe harbor before we go on to what you're about to say next, Fred, is they also in the safe harbor only used annuities as the calculation methodology for the income stream. They didn't use withdrawal strategies or anything else. And that'll also be a major point of comment, I think, as to whether DOL is favoring one industry over another and whether that's the right metric to use and, you know, how did they calculate the annuity and all those sorts of other issues.
Yeah. We've got a couple of minutes left, and then we have to go to Q&A. Looking at the rest of the things we plan to talk about today, I think we'll talk about IRA rollovers, and then we'll carry the other three issues, which primarily impact record keepers, over to our next program a quarter from now. But talking about the GAO report, just a few weeks ago, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, came out with its report on the rollover, the IRA rollover services of providers, meaning record keepers. And the report was critical of record keepers. To give you an example, the report, the GAO representatives actually called up call centers at record keepers and said the representative said that they had were entitled to a distribution from a plan and asked what they should do. The GAO rather then recorded those conversations and placed them on their website so that you or I can go and listen to them. In addition, they quoted from those conversations in the report that they issued to Congress. also, and if you read those, you know, I haven't listened to the tapes, but I've read the report. And essentially, the GAO is asserting by quoting from the recordings that the call centers are giving partial, inaccurate, or misleading information, encouraging people to roll their money into IRAs with proprietary funds of the record keeper. The misleading kind of information are your IRA is free. I mean, that's what the GAO is saying, that's misleading, because they're not talking about the revenue sharing or management fees or expense ratios that are involved with the mutual funds. Also, they're saying other things like you should go to an IRA, or an IRA is advantageous to you because it has more investment options in it. Without mentioning that if your plan offers brokerage accounts, you could do the same thing there. So without mentioning that there are lower cost investments inside, or there may be inside the plan, and the perhaps the investments inside the IRAs would be more expensive. But on the other hand, I think most people do want to pull their money out of the plan. They do want to control it themselves. They want that feeling of ownership and control, and they don't give much credit to the fact that the statistics may simply support that that's what people want to do. So in any event, that was sent to the Department of Labor, and the Department of Labor agreed with it and said, yes, we think there's a problem as well. And some people feel that GAO report is really biased. Just to give you a fair understanding, there's a lot of controversy about their tactics, a lot of controversy about whether they fairly reported on what's going on. And so don't accept it necessarily at face value that what the GAO said is fully representative of what's going on in the marketplace or of how providers deal with these issues. Nonetheless, it's out there, and we now have to think about what the impact of it is. I believe that the Department of Labor will probably say that GAO report is proof that the distribution and rollover process needs to be further regulated, and that they will then include that regulation in their reproposed fiduciary advice offering later this year. So I think we're going to see more regulation of distributions than IRA rollovers. Brad, what do you think?
No, I absolutely agree. In the original 2010 DOL rule, which was a proposal that was withdrawn, they didn't have a specific proposal on rollovers, but they asked the question, is DOL's current position on rollovers sufficiently protective of workers? And it's, in a nutshell, the DOL current position is if you're not a fiduciary to the plan, then it really isn't an ERISA issue in terms of soliciting a rollover. You're effectively governed by the conduct regulation of whatever type of provider you are, but it's not really an ERISA issue. That's an oversimplification. I mean, if you're a non-fiduciary service provider to the plan, there are certainly things you want to be aware of from an ERISA perspective. But, for example, if you're cold calling a plan participant and you're unaffiliated with that plan, then DOL had taken the view that that's not really an ERISA question. So they asked already, do we want to look at that again and see if that's sufficiently protective? And what I think all of us are hearing is that they are going to do something to further regulate rollovers. And what that something is, though, I think is the real critical question. Will they come out with a new prohibited transaction exemption that allows rollovers to proceed in an orderly way that we could all, use to advantage and eliminate concerns and gray area that might be out there, for example, for fiduciaries to plans who also have, rollover interest? Maybe, although I'm not probably betting that. I think it might be more likely that DOL would assert that rollovers and advice regarding rollovers and solicitations are fiduciary in nature, which I think would raise some new problems. But either way, I think we're definitely going to see DOL do something in this space.
Yeah, I've heard some people even assert that when an advisor tells a participant to take a distribution and roll over with them, that necessarily is individualized investment advice, because that tells a participant to liquidate their account. Sell all your investments in the plan and take a distribution and invest with me. and that it's a fiduciary act to tell a participant to sell their investments in the plan, even if it's implicit rather than explicit. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just saying
I would disagree with that based on the 2005 advisory opinion that DOL put out. If you're unaffiliated with the plan, I think that that would not be a fiduciary act. But we can debate all that later. At the end of the day, DOL is very likely to do something in this area. And in fact, as much controversy as the fiduciary rule has generated already, this would be, in my opinion, a new flashpoint in the debate.
The other issue I want to point out for plan sponsors is that in Interpretive Bulletin 96-1, the DOL created the concept of endorsement. By the time you read through it, it seems to say that if you only allow one person to have access to your participants, to talk to your participants about, in that case, investments, but in this case, let's say plan distributions. And the distributions from a plan are a fiduciary act, as opposed to, some of the steps that follow. But if you only allow your provider to have direct access to your participants to discuss distributions and what the advantages and disadvantages of various forms of distributions are, then based on that, and the language in an interpretive bulletin, it's conceivable that an argument could be made that you have endorsed your service provider's distribution services. On the other hand, the guidance says if you generally let people come in and talk to your participants, that's another deal. But who really does? So my point to plan sponsors is it's not clear. The answer isn't clear, but you're probably better served by understanding what's being said to your participants, what kind of information is being said to them, or given to them, what the scripts are for the call centers, so that you can see if, as a plan committee member, if as a fiduciary, you agree with that. And in fact, there's a little bit of language in the GAO report that suggests that outcome. So as a plan sponsor, you're probably safer making sure that you agree with what's going on than just assuming that you have no responsibility for it at all. Brad, we're at the witching hour. We better open this up for some questions or we won't have any time for Q&A at all. We will stay on the line for a few extra minutes. Alicia, do you want to open it up for questions?
Yes, sir. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Once again, that's star 1 to ask a question at this time. And we will take our first question.
This is Joe Abate in New York City. How's everybody doing?
Okay, how are you?
Good. Thanks for the information today. I appreciate it. Early on in the call, you talked more about revenues by an RIA. Either they're going to, fee for service and getting some 12B1s as well. Is that going to impact the type of, platform that they're going to be using, an insurance company type? A product where they kind of customize what that advisor wants up front as far as costs, anything along those lines that you can comment on?
With regard to the compensation of the advisor?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think for the reasons that we discussed as well as some others that we didn't get to today, advisors generally, fiduciary and non-fiduciary, but particularly fiduciary advisors, which ordinarily an RIA would be a fiduciary advisor, have to levelize their compensation. And actually, it's fairly easy to do that through a group annuity contract, which would be, one form of an insurance-provided plan. But the second step of that is that I know many of the group annuity contract providers, the insurance companies, have a whole range of what are equivalent to share classes for mutual funds, sort of separate account classes, where it covers the advisor's compensation, payments to the record keeper, and so on. I think that the direction we're going it would be good risk management when you originally advise a plan sponsor to select that platform to go through the different separate account classes and say, you know, my compensation for doing this kind of work is 25 basis points or, you know, a quarter of a percent per year. That fits within these. This company has 15 separate account classes. These three will pay me that amount. These different over here, it's revenue sharing or payments to the provider. I think this one is the right one for you if you want the plan to carry its own cost. In other words, I think that it is safer for advisors generally, and particularly for fiduciary advisors, to discuss share classes in a mutual fund environment and separate account classes in a group annuity contract. Having said that, I think you can levelize your compensation pretty easily in a group annuity contract. Brad?
Yeah, let's just clarify one thing, because I don't want people to misunderstand what we said earlier. You can be a fiduciary and still receive 12b-1 fees, for example. You don't have to be paid solely by the plan. You can also be paid by the investments and then be receiving 12b-1 or other fees. The issue is whether those fees are levelized, as Fred said. So whether you're paid directly by the plan, directly by the investments, or a combination of the two, that's all permissible as long as at the end of the day you don't have a differential financial interest in the outcome of those investments. So in an insurance environment, you can do that through the different separate account classes. You can also do that in a mutual fund environment, looking at the different share classes and also looking at potentially rebating some portion of fees from one, say, fund company to another if there's a differential in 12b-1 so that goes back to the plan. I just wanted to clarify that it's not that you can't get indirect compensation. It's that you have to make sure you're getting it the right way.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question.
Yes, this is Karen Hook in Des Moines, Iowa.
Thanks, Karen.
I think, hello. I think you may have answered this question, but I got pulled away for a minute, so I missed it. So I apologize for the redundancy. But you were talking about the DC accumulation and whether DB and DC were going to be combined. And I missed that part of it. So that was one question. And then what are there going to be excise taxes or penalties associated with excess accumulation, or will you just be made to stop contributing?
If you're talking about the president's proposal in the budget,
yes.
Yes, people spent a lot of time trying to dig through all the documents to figure out exactly what they were proposing, and I think the general consensus is that the limitation would also include at least some of the DB payments, not just the DCs, although there's, you know, this was not a model of clarity either in exactly how it would work. It was kind of the first draft of an idea that no one had really looked at before. As I understand it, it would be an excess. What would happen is, let's say you reach the amount of money that's equal to the annuity they're saying that you know, in this case roughly $3 million, you would be prohibited from making additional contributions, and they would be treated as if they were excess contributions, so you would have 2.5 months into the next year to rebate them and all of that. So there'd be a process for unwinding an excess contribution. But where it didn't really get into it was, well, how would you deal with the fact that accumulation amount is going to fluctuate up and down and would therefore require a lot of attention and diligence on the part of, you know, both plan, IRA, and the individual in all those different contexts to keep track of that and know when they contribute and when they can't.
Yeah, just to add to what Brad said, my understanding is the same as Brad's, but to go beyond that, if you've accumulated too much under that definition, $3.4 million, or if interest rates go down, say, $2.5 million, you never have to kick back the growth that results from your investments. Or if you were below the limit, but then it goes down and you're above the limit, you never have to kick that back either. So if it's just the growth of investments, you don't have to worry about it, other than the fact that it may cap your ability to have future contributions and accruals and qualified plans and IRAs. And then, as Brad said, if you do accidentally make a contribution when you're over the limit, you can kick it back within a specified time limit.
So would those limits be, when would they be calculated? Would it be at the end of the year we calculate whether you're over the limit and you can't contribute for the year coming up, or, you know, is it during the year? I mean, is that unclear?
First, I'll leave that to Brad because he studied it more closely than I have. But our conclusion was that this isn't going to become the law.
Right.
So we don't think it's actually going to happen. But, Brad, I don't remember saying
it. I have to confess, I can't remember that level of detail either. I would just fall back on the notion that if this went through, it would be incredibly complex because you're having to coordinate across both group and individual, you know, plan and non-plan entities. I mean, it would require a lot of work with the individual in connection with all of their various financial service providers and plans. It's just on a feasibility scale. It rates pretty low as something that could in any way reasonably be implemented, I think.
Okay.
But if they ever actually got to that, then the IRS would have to sort through all these issues, and you'd probably get a lot of guidance on these implementation questions.
Thank you.
But probably not for several years after it actually went into effect if we follow current practice.
We'll take our next question.
Yes, you're on.
Pam Lee from Florham Park. With regard to the GAO report, I'm not condoning, what these service providers may have done, but it just occurred to me while you were talking that when a participant takes a distribution, they're required to get the 402F notice, which if you look at it, it's called a rollover notice, and it just, focuses the participant's attention on IRA rollovers. So, I wonder if the GAO report mentioned anything about that.
Yes, it did. And it condemned them, too. The GAO was in a grouchy mood. The GAO essentially said that the materials being given to participants are not, it don't completely describe the alternatives and are too technical and too voluminous and that people need clear and complete information, and I believe the DOL agreed with that, and I think the Treasury Department or the IRS agreed with it as well, or at least acknowledged it and said they would work on it. But yes, they pretty much hit everybody as the process being flawed in some regards. On the other hand, just take a deep breath and stand back. And while acknowledging that there are some problems, by and large, if you look at it on a very big picture, the system seems to be working. People's money is being rolled over. Hopefully, lots of it. I think there's a bigger issue on people taking money out, paying taxes on it, and spending it than there is on money being rolled over to IRAs. So it's clearly not our biggest issue. And even there, it seems like folks are doing the right thing by putting it in IRAs and continuing to be invested. I do think that going forward that providers are going to have to focus on helping participants take that money in their IRAs and then develop distribution schemes, including investments and annuities that are specifically designed for the distribution of retirement money. But that's another issue. In any event, yeah, they were critical of the government guidance for participants in this area.
And if I could just take a moment to get on my soapbox about the GAO, I think the GAO is an entity that has a purpose. There's a reason why it's there, and it makes sense to have kind of that quasi-independent voice looking at various government programs. But in my experience, having dealt with the GAO on these kinds of investigations for quite some time, institutionally, they don't know what they don't know. when they come out with these reports, they're given this high level of importance and this real stamp of legitimacy, which I think you might be surprised if you actually sat down and talked with them how little sometimes they know starting in, and how, if you were going to hire someone to do this report to really give you the best view, I don't know that you would hire GAO to do it. This guess is what I would say.
I hear you.
Okay, Operator, we have time for one more question.
Yes, sir. We will take our last question.
Hello. This is Karen Potter from the West Coast. I have a question regarding the participant statements that you were talking about, the monthly income and the projections. That generally is for the quarterly participant statements put out by custodians. does that also apply to the pooled account where you only do a statement once a year?
My recollection, and Brad, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it applies to all defined contribution plans.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Both participant-directed, who have the quarterly requirement, and the annual non-participant-directed DC plans. I'm 95% sure there's a small chance I'm wrong about that, but I do believe it applies to both, at least as originally conceived in this pre-proposal.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, Brad, one more quarter. Thank you very much. We appreciate the chance to talk to you all. Remember that this will be posted on the Drink Rebuttal website, www.drinkrebuttal.com/beltway.
Yeah, thank all of you for giving us just a little over an hour of your time. We certainly appreciate it and hope that you continue to find these valuable.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
And that concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation.